1 Corinthians chapter 9. This last Friday, we had the opening ceremonies for the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And I believe this is an appropriate time for us to reference Paul's writings concerning the ancient games. So we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. But I'd like to begin by reading in verse 14. Even so hath the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. But I have used none of these things, neither have I written these things, that it should be so done unto me. For it were better for me to die than that any man should make my glorying void. For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of. For necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. You see here that Paul has this burning desire to preach the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. What is my reward then? Verily that, when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Now, many have taken this passage and have abused it and made this an excuse for them to practice anything in order to give somebody the gospel. They will lower their standards. They will do whatever it takes in order to have the opportunity to give somebody the gospel. And they misinterpret this as an excuse for doing so. That I am become all things to all men so that I might win some. And so they will literally start practicing things that are unscriptural in order to try to win somebody to Christ. And they say that the end justifies the means. That is not at all what Paul is saying here. Yes, anything that I can do scripturally in order to win somebody to Christ, yes, I will do that. But as he says in the very next verse, and this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partaker thereof with you. It is the gospel. And then he says this in verse 24, know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run, or in other words, so you ought to run, that ye may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now, they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. No doubt the Apostle Paul was a lover of sports. He uses sports to illustrate points that pertain to the Christian life. The Corinthians would have been familiar with sports since the Isthmian Games were held every 3 years at Corinth, the ancient games, the ancient Olympics. But those ancient games were quite a bit different from the modern games that you're going to see in Rio. There were fewer events in this day. For example, they did have boxing, but they had fewer rules than we have today. I read that they fought without rounds until one man was knocked out or admitted he had been beaten. There were no rules against hitting the opponent when he was down. And there were no weight classes. The opponents were chosen at random. And instead of gloves, they had leather thongs wrapped around their hands and their wrists, and their fingers were free. Can you imagine a boxing match like that today? Paul alludes to that right here when he says in verse 26, not as one that beateth the air. I'm not just boxing the air. They had running, four types of races at Olympia. There was the 210-yard sprint, which was the length of the stadium. The stadion. By the way, that word stadion appears in verse 24. It's the word race. Stadion. It was the oldest event of the games. There was the two-stayed race, 420 yards, the long distance run, and that ranged from 7 to 24 stades, in other words, 1,470 to 5,040 yards. Then there was the 2 to 4 stayed, 420 to 840 yards, that was a race that was run by the athletes with all the armor on. The armor weighing up to 60 pounds. I think my son Benjamin knows a little bit about that. They do it with 70-pound backsacks. But these guys had armor, helmets, and everything, and they would race with that on. Then they had the pentathlon, a five-event combination of discus, javelin, jumping, running, and wrestling. Those who won, the victors, they received a crown made with olive leaves. There was not a gold and a silver and a bronze. But they lived off the glory of their achievement even after the games. They were heroes. They would go back to their hometown, and the hometown might reward them with free meals for the rest of their lives. Cash. Tax breaks. You see, they had taxes back then too. Honorary appointments or leadership positions in the community, all for winning the races. They were heroes. They were celebrities. Last week, we looked at 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. And the challenge there was, folks, we need to get serious about the Christian life. Seriously. We need to get serious about the Christian life. Well, here, Paul likens Christian living to an athletic contest. If you're going to get serious about the Christian life, then there's three things in this passage you need to know about the contest of Christian living. Let's look at those three things this morning. Here's the first thing. It's the exhortation in this contest. And here's the exhortation. It's one word. It's the word, run. How many of you guys played football in high school or even college? Did you ever have a coach that said, run? You didn't? We'd be so dead tired. The coach would scream at us, run! It's almost what is being said here. It's an exhortation. It's a command. Thus, you must be running. It's an imperative that calls for a constant attitude. It's in the present tense. You must constantly be running. When we lived on the farm in Monroe, Nebraska, my dad would sometimes work at home. He was an insurance salesman, but there would be times that we would spend time with him on the farm. And he'd be in the shop, and all six of us boys would be around him. I don't know if Mike remembers this or not. And we'd be helping him do something. And all of a sudden he would say, I need such and such. One of you boys, go get that. And it might have been a tool way down in another barn. And I remember loving to run to go get that. And I would run to go get that particular tool, knowing that he needs it right now. So run. Why in the Christian life should we run? Now you're thinking physically. You're thinking, okay, we know after church, let's all go outside and let's run. You know this is a spiritual metaphor. On how you live your Christian life on a daily basis. So why should we run? Why do you run? We run to race. And that's what he says here. Know ye not that they which run in a race run all? They run in a race. So we run to race. Let's look first of all at the place of the race. I've already said it's the stadion or the stadium. That's where we get our word stadium. Paul speaks of the Christian as an athlete. Now you may say, I've never been athletically inclined. No, physically, you may not have ever been athletically inclined. But if you are a Christian, you are a spiritual athlete. And Paul says, know ye not that they which run, run all. You are not called to be a spectator. You are called to be an athlete. And the reason I'm saying that we need to get serious about the Christian life is because the Christian life is not a spectator sport. It is a sport where everybody is running. If I could go through this entire audience and start naming names one at a time and name your name, I would say your name, including mine, and saying, folks, we are in a race. And we are to be running. We are on the track. We are not supposed to be in the stands. Now, there is somebody in the stands watching us. It's the world. And they're watching everything you do. There are some Christians who heavily participate in many of life's contests, and that's not bad. I want a job promotion, and boy, you compete heavily for that job promotion. There are some golfers here, and boy, they compete in golf. Guys who like to get together and play basketball, and there's nothing wrong with that. Those who, when it comes to academics, compete in academics. When I was taking elementary Greek, I had almost flunked History of Civilization the first semester. Somebody said, whatever grade you make in History of Civilization is what you're going to make in Greek. Scared me. I got a D in History of Civilization. Freshman year, first semester. When my roommate told me that, I put the pedal to the metal. Second semester, History of Civilization. And I came that close to an A minus. From a D to an A minus. The next year was my sophomore year. I knew I was coming up with Greek. I found who I thought might be the best guy in the class. You know what I did? I sat beside him. Every time we had a quiz, I said, I'm going to compete with this guy, and I'm going to beat him. And I did. I was at the top of the class in Greek. By the end of that first semester, I had 102% in my Greek. I had missed nothing when they gave a quiz. I didn't. Now, you're thinking, wow, you must be a Greek scholar. Please, I am not. Because today, when I go to my Greek New Testament, it's still a challenge. That was my first semester anyway. But I loved to compete in academics. That's what challenged me. That's what allowed me to really excel when I competed. So folks, the point is this, we compete in so many areas of our lives. And then all of a sudden, when it comes to participating in Christian life service, we become spectators. We watch as other Christians are doing the service. Whether it be church, you just come and sit. Others do the singing. Others do the praying. By the way, praying's work. Others do the teaching. It's others who do the ushering. It's others who do the cleanup. It's others who do the soul winning. It's others, others. That's just one application of running the Christian life's race. Folks, we are in the race. We are not spectators. Now, the spectator may pay admission, but he has no energy to put forth. You know what an armchair quarterback is. Somebody who sits at home and screams at the TV because the quarterback's not doing what he thinks the quarterback ought to do. But here's the guy sitting in his armchair drinking his Dr. Pepper and eating his Doritos, screaming at the guy who's on the field who's exerting all the energy. And that same picture plays out almost every week in the church. Who becomes the greatest critics in the church? Do you know who it is? It's the spectators. Well, that's not the way that should be done. Okay, how would you like to do it? Oh, I don't want to do that. Oh, please don't. Okay. Who should be the spectators? The world. Watching the Christian. When I was in China just a couple of weeks ago, Philip, my interpreter, took me to the 2008 Beijing Olympic Stadium. And as we were talking, I was talking to him about China's teams and what they're going to be doing with their participation in the Olympics in Rio. And Philip made a kind of a funny statement. He said, out of 1.4 billion people, you would think we would have 11 good soccer players. And we have nothing. And when he said that, I thought, you know what? The odds aren't very good for having a very good soccer team out of 1.4 billion people. But you would think in churches, and our church is an average-sized church in the United States, believe it or not, 75 to 80. You would think that in a church, you would have 100% participation. But sometimes it's hard to find just a few. 11 good soccer players out of 1.4 billion. You know why people sit in the stands? Because being in the race requires commitment. Paul is rebuking the Galatian church in Galatians chapter 5, 7 when he says, you did run well. Who did hinder you that ye should not obey the truth? You Galatians, at one time you ran well. Who's hindering you now? And it's always so interesting to me that when somebody first gets saved, you know, they're on fire for the Lord because they know what the Lord did for them. And boy, they're excited and they're wanting to get involved. And then they start to get to know the rest of the Christians who's been sitting in the pew for all those years. And they begin to become a spectator too. Yeah, you did run well. Who did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? And so we see there the place of the race is the stadium. Then we see the competitor in the race. Who's competing? As you run the Christian race, with whom are you competing? Are you competing with everybody else here in the church? Are you competing with other Christians? Is that the race? Are we trying to see which Christian is really doing the most on the outside? Is this an outward exhibition? Is that what this race is all about? I don't believe the competitor is other Christians. That's easy. You can always find somebody else you can beat. I mean, I can always find, you know, if I'm going to play golf, I'm not going to go up against Brother Mark Benson. He's going to cream me. I'd like to go with him so he can teach me. But I'm going to find somebody who here has never played golf. See, I want to play with you folks. Because I might be able to beat you. And this is how we do it in the Christian life. We find somebody else who's, you know, just kind of a little bit lower than I, and I can compare myself to them, and I can, hey, I'm not so bad. But the competition is not with other believers. I'm going to tell you something. When I was in the fifth grade, I was the top student in my class. I was at the top. It was a one-room schoolhouse. There were two fifth graders. I was one of them. You see, you can always find some kind of a situation where you can say, I shine. You know, my mom and dad could have had this on their bumper sticker. My child was number one in his fifth grade. You're competing with your flesh. You're competing with what your flesh wants you to. You are your own competitor. Turn with me to Galatians chapter 5, where this is not an athletic reference, but a military reference, but the application, I believe, applies. Galatians chapter 5, where the Apostle Paul is talking about the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. And he says this in Galatians 5:16, "This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh." Who's competing here? It's the flesh and the Spirit. And these are contrary the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. You know what the competition is? It's your flesh. You are in this contest with your flesh every morning when it's time to get up. And the alarm goes off. Oh, I really know I should get up. And okay, let's say it's time for your devotions. This is when you have devotions. I really know I should have my devotions, but this. And then the snooze alarm goes off. And then after five more clicks, yeah, what's winning? It's the flesh. You are your own competitor. And by the way, that's what every athlete competes against before qualifying for the Olympics. I can always be better. I need to strive a little bit harder. They're not yet competing. They're not yet in the game. And so they're competing with one another. My time can be better. Or maybe you think you're already perfect. Paul makes a reference to that in Philippians. You were in Galatians. Go a few books after that to Philippians chapter 3. Notice this other athletic reference that he makes. Philippians chapter 3 verses 12, 13, and 14. "Not as though I had already attained, either were already perfect. But I follow after." This is a word, that word follow is a word for striving. "If that I may apprehend that for which also I am apprehended of Christ Jesus. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark." That word press is the word for persecution. "I am persecuting toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus." It is a constant agonizing. It is a constant running. It is a constant just agonizing in this race. And so for the believer, it's a realization that I must be growing. I must be increasing. You see, when you know that the standard is perfection, you can always do better. But when you compete with somebody else, there you've got your standard. Well, nobody else comes on Wednesday night. Oh, is that your standard? Well, nobody else, anytime you have to put nobody else in there, is that your standard? Why do you run? To race. But secondly, right here in the same verse, why do you run? To win. Why would you get involved in a race if you're not going in it to win? "Know ye not that they which run in a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that ye may win, so that ye may obtain." Two words I want you to focus on, the word "one." There is this flabby, sissy attitude in the world that has infected Christian thinking, and that is everybody's a winner. You know, our boys played soccer when they were little, and every one of them got the same trophy. I hate that. "Thank you for participating. You get a participation trophy." Nobody wins, everybody does. Baloney. Someone wins. And it's your team or mine, and we're coming out here to beat you. You know, athletics is very discriminating. Paul says, one receiveth the prize. Uno. Is that right, Imelda?
Uno. Eins. Any crowds here? Is that for one? Uno. Eins. One. How many win? One.
Michael Phelps, I believe it was in 2008, won the 100 meter by, and this astounds me, 1/100th of a second. Because one has to win. One wins. It's the same thing in the Christian Olympics, in the contest of Christian living. There's one winner. It's either your flesh or it's the Spirit. Every decision you make, one is a winner. You decide to skip your devotions, the flesh is one. What's the attitude of believers? Well, both the Spirit and the flesh can win. They're both going to get trophies. You've adopted the thinking of this world. Folks, that's not true in Rio, and that is not true in the Christian life. One receiveth the prize. And it's that word prize is the second word I want to focus on. That word is used only here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, and again in chapter 3 and verse 14 of Philippians. I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. What's the prize for the believer? Is it heaven? No, it's not heaven, but it is heavenly reward. It's the praise of the Savior at the Bema seat. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Well done. Boy, I want to hear those words, don't you? Man, you ran the race well. And when I think of that, I think of all the ways I haven't run the race well at all. As I get older, I begin to see so many things. Oh, this is left undone. This is undone. And boy, I had thought this was going to be done by this time in my life and so forth. And I'm thinking about this race that I'm in. And it's very sobering. There are some who will make it to heaven, but will have no rewards in heaven. If any man's work abide which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward, but some... And I believe this is where we get the phrase, skin of their teeth. Comes right out of that same chapter. Saved, yet so as by fire. Folks, everybody is running. Everyone here is running. Everyone. But what you are running for determines the prize. Are you running for your flesh, or are you running for the spiritual things? You know, the prophet Haggai, in his book, chapter 1 and verse 9, he is having to rebuke the people, saying, every man runs to his own house. You see, they were neglecting the building of the temple. And he's saying, all of you are running to your own house. You have houses that have nice, they're sealed, C-E-I-L-E-D. You've got these wonderful houses, and yet the house of the Lord remains in ruins. And he rebukes the people. You see, everybody is running. They were running to their houses, but nobody was running for the house of the Lord. So there is the exhortation in this contest. Secondly, I want you to see the exercise for this contest. Look at verse 25. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now, they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Here, the word I want you to understand is the word exercise. First of all, under this, what all give? Because it says, every man that striveth. Striveth for the mastery is one word in the Greek. It's the word agonize. It means everyone engaged in an athletic contest. It has to do with giving 100%. My football coach, Larry Miller, would ask us at the end of a practice, did you give 100%? At the end of every game, did you give 100%? Why can we not ask the same of Christians? Why is it admirable to give 100% in athletics but not give 100% for the Lord? Why is that? But every man that striveth for the mastery is what? What's the word? He's temperate. One who controls himself, somebody who is exercising self-control in all things, doing what you want to do, doing what you don't want to do, and not doing what you want to do. Being temperate requires striving. It requires agonizing in all things. Let me give you the quote from a gold medal winner from the 1976 decathlon. He said, "I always felt that my greatest asset was not my physical ability, it was my mental ability." Now, tell me who won the 1976 decathlon. Bruce Jenner, who now claims he's a woman. And he says, "My greatest ability was my mental ability." He was temperate in one thing, winning the decathlon, a complete failure in life. And yet that's what happens to a lot of Christians. They can compete in every kind of sport, but when it comes to the spiritual aspect, complete failures. He had self-control mentally in athletics only, not in everyday living. And it shows today. One of the Greek references I read says, "All endeavors of the athlete are in vain if he has not trained his body and abstained from all that might in any way harm his physical condition." Paul seems to be referring to the training period during which time the athlete was under strict rules. When an athlete is under training, it's strict. Another commentator, "The strenuous self-denial of the athlete in training for his fleeting reward is a rebuke to the half-hearted, flabby Christian service." Notice that the athlete denies himself many lawful pleasures. The Christian must avoid not only definite sin, but anything that hinders his complete effectiveness. It's what all give. But secondly, what they get. They do it to obtain what? In the real Olympics, all are competing for something. The gold medal. You say, "Well, that's permanent." Well, my Bible says that everything in this world and all its works is going to be burned up. Perishable. They do it for a corruptible crown. When Carl Lewis won the gold medal and then his father passed away, it is reported that he took that gold medal, went to his father's casket, and put the gold medal in his father's hand in the casket before they closed the casket and buried him. And then he told his mother, "Don't worry, Mom, I can get another one. I can just go get another one." That's the kind of reward. I can just go get another one, but not for the Christian. There's that prize. And it's very difficult to train. Michael Phelps described conditioning, the conditioning demanded by Coach Bob Bowman during the 24-day stint he had in Colorado Springs, where Phelps and his teammates endured 50-mile training weeks in the pool. Quote from Michael Phelps, "All you do is eat, sleep, swim. It's painful, but it's worth it in the end." And really, the Christian life is a joyful life, but sometimes it's painful, isn't it? But you know what we're going to be able to say when we get to heaven? It will be worth it all when we see Jesus. Where are those crowns won in the ancient Olympics that were so admired? That wreath of olive leaves they would put on their head. Where are those crowns today? They're decayed, just like the athletic bodies of those who wore them. What they get, a perishable crown. What we get, and this is what he says here, we, an incorruptible. We get an incorruptible. Five crowns in the Bible. There's the crown of rejoicing for faithful witnessing, 1 Thessalonians 2:19. There's the crown of righteousness for loving the coming of Jesus Christ, 2 Timothy 4:8. There's the crown of life for enduring trials, James 1:12, Revelation 2:10. There's the crown of glory for faithful pastors, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 4. And here, this is the incorruptible crown for laying up treasure in heaven, 1 Corinthians 9, verse 25. Imperishable. It never perishes. Folks, where are the crowns that every believer, the we that Paul is talking about here, where is that crown? It's awaiting you. It is awaiting you. There was this older couple who, on a stormy night, needed lodging. So at 1 o'clock in the morning, they went to this hotel where there was this clerk, and in town there had been three conventions. And the clerk said, "Well, I'm sorry, we're full. Would you be willing to sleep in my room?" And this older couple was astounded. So the next morning they came to pay the bill, and the older man of the couple said, "You're the kind of man who should be the manager of the best hotel in the United States. Maybe someday I'll build one for you." And the clerk smiles at them, amused at his little joke. Years later, that hotel clerk gets a letter inviting him to New York for a visit. And in that letter is a round-trip ticket enclosed. He goes to New York, and the host takes him to the corner of 5th Avenue and 34th Street to a magnificent building. And the man said, "This is the hotel I built for you to manage." The guy says, "You're joking. Who are you?" "My name is William Waldorf Astor." That hotel was the original Waldorf Astoria, and the young clerk who became its first manager was George C. Bolt, who had done something for that man, got a tremendous reward. But even today, that means nothing to him. What they get, perishable. What we get, imperishable. I've got a nice room awaiting me, because Jesus is there. He says, "I go to prepare a place for you. And I'm going to come again. I'm going to receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you might be also." And so there, folks, we have the exercise. Then we close with the example in this contest. It's the Apostle Paul, verses 26 and 27. Now he refers to himself. He's talking about the Athletic Olympics, the Olympics in verses 24 and 25. And now he says, "Now I therefore so run." This is how I run in my Christian life. "Not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beateth the air." So look at his running there in verse 26, the first part. It's not aimless. Paul now applies to himself and how he competes, his own contest. Paul is not like a runner who does not know where the finish line is. He knows where the finish line is because his eye is on the goal. "I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus." And it says here, "not as uncertainly." I don't run aimlessly, literally. There's his running. Then we see his boxing in the last part of verse 26. His boxing is not aerial. "So fight I. In this manner I am boxing, not as somebody who is beating the air." Vincent, a commentator in the Greek, says a boxer might be said to beat the air when practicing without an adversary, expending his energy worthlessly, blows that don't land, a shadow boxer. Paul is not as a boxer who does not engage his opponent. Shadow boxing may be good exercise, but it does not defeat the opponent. I don't beat the air. This is serious. We know the little phrase, "Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." In other words, everything else you do that does not have eternal consequences is like an Olympian boxing the air. So we see here his running, his boxing, and then we see his body in verse 27. "I keep under my body. What is his opponent? It's my body. It's the flesh. I keep it under. Literally, I am striking it under the eye. I am beating it black and blue. I am bringing it into subjection. I am enslaving my body. Really, when it comes down to it, what is most people's problems? It's that tent that you're living in, that I'm looking at right now, and that you're looking at. Folks, our bodies should be our servant, not our master. And if you're going to win this race, you have to keep under your body and bring it into subjection. Lest that by any means, when you preach to others, you yourself are a castaway. Why was Paul so serious about running and boxing and enslaving his body so that he would not be disqualified when he preached to others? What is being unqualified? What does that have to do with? Losing your salvation? Is Paul concerned about losing his salvation? No. The disqualified Greek athlete did not lose his citizenship, but he lost the prize. And with that loss, he also earned shame and disgrace. What are we willing to endure for an earthly prize? A trophy? That's fleeting. Every trophy that Paul Halad makes is gone. Do we expend an equal amount of energy and time to things that really matter? Some here may not be disqualified from certain athletic endeavors, but as a Christian, you may be unworthy. So to follow up last week's message on getting serious about the Christian life, folks, here's the contest of Christian living. And let's not give up, remembering. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Be not weary in well-doing, for in due season you will reap if you faint not. Let's run. And when we box, not with each other, but as we're involved in this athletic contest of the spiritual life, not as somebody who beats the air. Living for the Lord is a serious matter, but it's a joyful thing. And one day the reward comes. One day the reward comes.